I'm Nancy Diamond.
And I'm Jerry.
And this is the session entitled Simplicity, Fad or Faithfulness. And if you want, we can answer the question right away, and then anyone who's looking for the answer to the question can leave. If you're not satisfied with just the answer, you can stick around to see how we flesh it out. I'd like to read from a book that we're going to be using heavily for this session called Freedom of Simplicity by Richard Foster. It's an excellent book. Read what Foster has to say in the answer to the question, is it fad or faithfulness? Christian simplicity is not just a faddish attempt to respond to the ecological holocaust that threatens to engulf us, nor is it born out of a frustration with technocratic obesity. It is a call given to every Christian. The witness to simplicity is profoundly rooted in the biblical tradition and most perfectly exemplified in the life of Jesus Christ. In one form or another, all the devotional masters have stressed its essential nature. It is a natural and necessary outflow of the good news of the gospel having taken root in our lives. So now you know. I'd like to ask you for a minute to ponder another question. What is your perception of the world in which you live? A couple days ago, Jerry and I went on a walk up to Holden Lake. And I don't know how many of you have taken this hike, but it was the first big hike we've taken since we came to Holden. And I started out pretty confident of what I was doing and tromped up the path. And I hadn't gone very far until I wanted to get a perspective on the mountains and everything around. So I kind of started gawking around. First thing I knew, I stumbled. So pretty quickly, I figured out that when I was walking on the path, I had to watch where I was doing. I had to keep my eye on the path. There were too many loose stones, too many holes, too many pitfalls. When I wanted to get a perspective around me, when I wanted to see the scenery, I had to stop walking and look around. When I got to places on the path that I perceived were more dangerous than others, I was very careful where I put my feet. Had to cross several brooks, came to one or two places where a misstep could send me down the mountainside. So I was extremely careful about where I put my feet. I think that that has a lesson for us in that when we perceive we're living in a critical time or we're living in a dangerous time, we pay more attention to how we walk or how we live. Now, if you don't perceive that there's a problem or you don't perceive that this is a critical time in which we live, then you can kind of float along, walking any old where and not being very careful. But if you perceive that maybe there's something kind of out of whack in the world and maybe we ought to pay attention to where we put our feet down, then you're more likely to do one thing at a time and stop and reflect upon where you are and where you're walking. I think there's a call today to become very conscious of how we live. To do this, we must take time to be silent, to be aware, to be mindful, to be meditative. And those various things Jerry has talked about in sessions over the last week and a half, if you've gone to any of the other sessions. So we're not going to zero in on a lot of those today, but want to emphasize that those are very important things as a background for talking about simplicity. Another book I'm going to use heavily is the book called Voluntary and Simplicity by Duane Elgin. He's done a lot of work in this area, and it's his opinion that a lot of people have already started this walk, that a lot of people have already begun to realize that the whole world's connected and that we're all one, and thus we really have to search for a lifestyle that connects people, nature, and God. Now, there are a lot of definitions of simplicity that we can use. We can describe it in many ways and use many reasons to choose a lifestyle of simplicity. But I do not think that a lecture or a talk on simplicity should be extremely complex. So I'm going to try to just give you a few key thoughts, something that you can, maybe a few key words you can keep in your mind and take home. And if you're interested in doing more reading, you'll find more things to read. I want to read a definition of simplicity that was written in 1936. So somebody recognized that there was a need to consider that as a lifestyle way before we perceived that we're running out of material resources. This was written by Richard Gregg in 1936, and he uses the term voluntary simplicity. Voluntary simplicity. And he describes it in this way. Voluntary simplicity involves both the inner and outer condition. It means singleness of purpose, sincerity and honesty within, as well as avoidance of exterior clutter, of many possessions irrelevant to the chief purpose of life. It means an ordering and guiding of our energy and our desires, a partial restraint in some directions in order to secure greater abundance of life in other directions. It involves a deliberate organization of life for a purpose. So, two aspects to voluntary simplicity. What does it mean to live voluntarily? And what does it mean to live simply? I think we use a couple words to describe voluntary living. It means living deliberately, intentionally, purposefully, or consciously, thinking, not just drifting along, mindless, but thinking about where you're going. Some intentionality or some consciousness. The other aspect of it is, what do we mean by simplicity? I think it's often been used, when you hear the word simplicity or simple living, to think austerity. I'd like to expand our thinking on that topic and say that I think living simply means having singleness of purpose. Being direct, being honest, getting rid of unnecessary distractions. What does that mean for the Christian? I think for the Christian it means living with one issue, that's holy obedience. Dietrich Bonhoeffer has said it just before he died at the hands of the Nazis. He said, to be simple is to fix one's eye solely on the simple truth of God at a time when all concepts are being confused, distorted, and turned upside down. So having a focus, living simply is having a focus. Jerry's going to talk a little bit about biblical traditions of simplicity.
Were you there already?
Yeah.
Oh, well, okay, hang on to your hat, because I don't know how long it's going to take. I didn't time this, but I'd like to try to, I'm going to dump a whole lot of stuff out on you. And
it's got to be simple.
And, well, yeah, okay. I guess the thing that Nancy and I like to emphasize, that simplicity, or we use the word simplicity deliberately.
This is
the season to be jolly. rather than simplifying your lifestyle, because the word lifestyle has gotten to be pretty much of a hackneyed word. But we really want to emphasize that what we are talking about in simplicity as a Christian discipline is not a new law. We're not trying to lay laws on people and say, my God, you got to get to be really simple. And you know, get into the whole mentality that used to be holier than thou, and then now it's going to be simpler than thou. What is the biblical basis for simplicity? Well, I'd like to say in kind of an overall word that the theme of Christian simplicity ought to be tremendous abandonment of joy. I mean, that's kind of where it comes from. And there are some passages in the Bible that are really astounding that may not sound at first in our ears even like simplicity. It may sound like extravagance, and really it is, because simplicity, in a sense, is a certain kind of extravagance. The root, I'll touch upon it as Old Testament and New Testament. First of all, in the Old Testament, I only can just give you just really quick pointers because it would take too long to go into any kind of depth on this. The question is not, is there a God in the Old Testament, or even for most people, what kind of a God is there? And the Old Testament answer to that begins right with the very first verse of the Bible. It's a God who creates, a God who is in charge, and a God who can be trusted and is abundant in what that God lays out. That's the kind of God we're talking about in the Bible. But along with God who creates and provides and has abundance, it also carries with it the theme that we are radically dependent on that God. And all the slogans of the world, to the contrary, notwithstanding, the Bible tells us we are radically dependent on God. And the Old Testament also points out to us that we need to be radically obedient to God, that God has a will, and that we can know what that will is, and we are to be obedient to it. And everything else that you heard about is idolatry. That's number one, is God. And that affluence can also become an idol. And so, in a sense, simplicity, as the Old Testament thinks of it, is freedom from a burden. It's a freedom from the burden of getting ahead. That's a burden to have to be always trying to get ahead. And I hear people use that expression quite a bit. Even when I was a kid, I remember my parents talking about an older cousin of mine who just got married, and now a year has passed, and you know, they're trying to get ahead. And I've always wondered, ahead of what? Ahead of whom? I never quite understood, even as a 11 or 12 year old, what that really meant. Well, that's a burden to be always trying to get ahead. Now, none of us, I think, would admit that we carry around in us a disease of covetousness. We would say, you know, it's like someone who has the problem of alcoholism. I mean, it's very difficult to recognize that you have a problem with alcohol. I've worked with some alcoholics, and the question is, who, me? I'm not an alcoholic. I just enjoy a drink now once in a while. Well, who, me? Covetous? No, I'm not covetous. I just, you know, when you're in it, and I think most of us in our American culture are in it, very hard to notice it. That there are some dominant themes in the Old Testament that I'd just like to point out that would help maybe get across the idea that simplicity is really a joyfulness. Creation is one. Our dependence on God is one. The generosity of God is another one. That's a dominant theme in the Old Testament. And when it talks about blessing in the Old Testament, who here took the Bethel Bible series? Anybody here? Wow, it's hard to find a crowd any longer that hasn't had a few people have taken it. But the blessing in the Old Testament isn't just some kind of nebulous spiritual thing. Blessing includes material things. It includes children and grandchildren, and includes inheritance and property, and you know, there is a physical aspect to it with a condition, and the condition is the one that Nancy pointed out: holy obedience. That the blessing that comes from God always carries with it being obedient to the will of God, which includes compassionate provision for the poor. And the importance of obedience it equals a kind of spirit that it works in us. That's the primary thing. It works a certain kind of spirit in us. And only secondarily to receive the blessing, the physical, material things. Sometimes God in the Old Testament withholds the material blessings for our greater good or our greater growth. But the Spirit is one which, in fact, you know, kind of crucifies greed. Also, I think that something we have to keep in mind in the Old Testament is the communal nature of material things. We look at it through our eyes, you know, ownership of something is very much an individual thing or a family. We own this car, we own these things, we own this. Material blessing was always a part of the community, the clan. I guess I know that's somewhat true, that was true at least, among some of the native peoples of this country who own things more or less communally. In the Old Testament also, that there comes along, and part of the law in the Old Testament was the law of Jubilee, that every 50 years, there would certain things would happen. The ownership of land would always revert back to the original owner. Slaves would be set free. Debts would be canceled. That was the idea of a jubilee. Happiness, that the burdens would be taken away. I guess I can just hit, I can see now that the time isn't going to allow to go very far in this. Let me just mention the tithe in the Old Testament. If you recall, the law of the tithe, the idea of giving 10%, it was 10% of what? Or 10... What was to be given in terms of sharing with the poor in the tithe? Anybody here know? What?
It was everything, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was 10% of everything, but it was of the 10% that you were to give was the first fruits. That really emphasizes the radical dependence on God. In other words, this acreage, I'm going to get 100 bushels off of here. The first 10 bushels I pull off, I just give. For the poor, the alien, the sojourner in the land, the orphans and the widows, in other words, those who had no access, no way of sustaining themselves, but it was the first 10 bushels. Now that says, now I got to trust God that 90 more bushels are going to come. You didn't wait till you got all 100 bushels and then took 10 of them. You took the first 10 and just gave them away and it was a big kind of big party. In fact, I'd like to see, maybe I can read it in here and it'd be a little... real quickly, because this is one of those passages that I think will, it might shock us if we start getting to think too tight. If you think that simplicity is being uptight and grim about it, and I'm gonna live like a simple miser and so forth. Now listen, this is from Deuteronomy. You shall tithe all the yield of your seed, and before the Lord your God you shall eat the tithe of your grain, of your wine, of your oil, of the firstlings of your herd and flock, that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always, and spend the money for whatever you desire, oxen, sheep, wine, strong drink, whatever your appetite craves, and you shall eat there before the Lord your God and rejoice, and you and your household. And you shall not forsake the Levite who is within your towns, for he has no portion or inheritance with you. Look at the picture of that. Absolutely. Crazy celebration. In other words, it's the very opposite of hoarding. You just, the whole town, let's just have what would be a good word for it? I mean, a real blast. And you cook and you drink and you have this big celebration. But why is the idea is celebration and not being hung up about, what am I going to do about retirement? Well, let me skip over. I'm going to have to jump to the New Testament very quickly here. I won't say anything about the New Testament. The New Testament, did you notice the New Testament doesn't say anything about tithing? That's not a law in the church. No place in the New Testament will you find it says about tithing. Why not?
Could it be the difference between law and gospel?
Yeah.
If you would not put the fact that this is the law.
They had taken the tithe idea and made it a rigid kind of law. And Jesus says to the Pharisees, you tithe mint and dill and cumin and you neglect the most important part of the whole thing, mercy and justice. And what's mint and dill and cumin? I mean, everybody here have an herb garden? That's a tiny little thing, you know? But they say, well, I'm tithing my crop. Well, it happens to be 13 stalks of mint, you know. But I'm tithing. See, they made a law out of it because the tithe didn't go far enough. In the Christian community, once the Spirit had infested the community and they understood what it was to live joyfully, you didn't have to tithe. I mean, everything was shared. It was that kind of thing. Well, I better stop because then Nancy's got some more things to say. We want to have some time for questions. But I guess if I would say there are many places in the New Testament to look for that attitude, but Matthew 6 would be one of the best ones, right in the middle of the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus just redundantly talks about things. Don't lay up treasures in heaven, on earth, where moth and rust and inflation corrupt. But it's not just a don't, see. It's a do lay up treasures before God in heaven. And he redundantly talks about that kind of stuff. He doesn't say, well, it just isn't very wise to try to serve both God and money. He says it's impossible. I mean, Jesus' words are shocking to us. But I'll make one last reference. How that begins to play itself within the early church then. And you see point, counterpoint in the book of Acts. Acts, I think, in the fourth chapter. It's the Spirit of God came upon these people. And then the very next verse it talks about, and they held all things in common, and they shared bread together. And the next verse says, and they did works with power. And then it goes back and says some more about how they shared things together. So if you try to think about simplicity as something like, God, I got to do this now. The first thing is really seeking the kingdom of God. That's always the emphasis. And we need to become simple in our spirit. Don't try to make a law out of it. It'll kill you. Something like that.
Well, we're probably far enough into talking about simplicity that you've got the idea that it's not simple. It is complex. I mean, how can you talk about simplicity and having big celebrations and giving away everything? So one thing I want to say is simplicity is not simplistic answers. It's not simplism, is that how you say it? It's not simplistic answers. In Christian simplicity, there's no four rules to follow, and then therefore you will be Christian, you will be living in Christian simplicity. If that's what you want, you might as well leave, because that's not what we've got, and there's no place you're going to get that. In fact, I think there are some complexities to simplicity that we need to face. There are paradoxes, four of them particularly, that I want to talk about, that we have to keep. It's a paradox, it's something you have to keep in tension there. The only way you arrive at truth in a paradox is to keep a balance between both ends of the paradox, or a tension. So the first thing I want to say is simplicity is a grace and a discipline. Okay, it's a grace and a discipline. How many of you know the Shaker hymn, "'Tis a gift to be simple, 'tis a gift to be free, 'tis a gift to come down where you want to be"? So 'tis a gift. First of all, I want to say simplicity is a grace. It's a gift of God. But the other part of the hymn says, to turn, turn will be our delight until by turning we come out right. So we have to do something. The discipline part of it is that, again, that word conscious that we had up there before. It's a consciously chosen course of action or lifestyle that puts us in a place where we can receive the gift. It's not that we earn the gift. It's that we put ourselves in a position or a posture or a place where we can receive the gift. So it's a paradox. We have to make some decisions. And then we're able to receive the gift. So it's a grace and a discipline. The second paradox is it's both easy and difficult. If you've ever tried to do something new, a new discipline, the discipline, maybe some of you who've been here have tried the discipline of solitude or silence, and you've never done that before. Was it easy? No, it's hard. At least I think it's hard. If you're trying to learn to play the piano, that discipline of practicing every day, that's not easy. That's difficult. If you're learning, you're a runner. When you started out running, to make that a discipline in your life, it wasn't easy. But after you get over that hump, after you just go through the difficult work of making it a discipline in your life, then it becomes easy. Now it's easy to run. Now it's easy to play the piano. I think that's why people who are really good at ice skating or piano playing or something, they sit down and they rip it off and we all say, boy, does that look easy. But we all know it's not easy. It wasn't easy at one time. So it's both difficult and easy. And this is maybe the most important paradox, is that it has to be a balance between our inner and outer life. If it doesn't flow out of an inner life, it becomes legalism. It's the most important thing to keep the balance of simplicity with the other Christian disciplines. And that's why when we're talking about spirituality, and Jerry had a number of sessions on spirituality in the last 2 weeks, simplicity wasn't the first one we talked about. And it's very dangerous to talk about it in isolation, so I want to, of the other disciplines, I want to really emphasize that solitude, prayer, meditation, mindfulness, those other things have to come first, or you're going to get into trouble. It's going to be legalistic. It's going to be a list of do's and don'ts that you're going to feel it's a burden. So don't isolate it. Okay, and the fourth one is that simplicity affirms both the goodness and the limitation of things. If any of you went to Rudy's presentation yesterday on earth keeping, I think he really came across with the goodness of creation that God has given us. All things were created good. But guess what, folks? There's a limit. There is a limit to creation, to all those good things. It's not choosing ugliness or deprivation, but it's realizing that we do have some limits and looking for the beautiful and the functional within those limits. Again, if we don't perceive that there's limits, we get into trouble. The other night I presume this was announced at both table settings. The night we had beef stroganoff, the waiter announced that there was a limit to the meat. I don't know what happened at your table, but at our table, there was an extreme carefulness that I noticed. Until we joked about the food went down this side and around the other side. And I do believe the man who was the last had the biggest portion of meat available to him. And we kind of joked about that. Maybe it was just because our awareness, we were made aware that there is a limit tonight to this meat. So just imagine for a moment what our response to the limits can be. Let's take the example of the meat in the kitchen. When that announcement was made, what are some responses beside the one that happened at our table? Can you imagine any other response you might have made?
Take more, or
take
try to get it first?
Yeah, that's good. That was the first one. And I've heard this justification. Suppose, for example, that you had been sitting there and they announced that, and you could have said, well, I'm a paying guest here. I mean, I saved my money all year to make this trip, and I deserve to have my appetite filled. I mean, I'm used to eating a lot of meat. I've got a college education. I'm a professional person. I got a good job. I make a lot of money. And I'm not depriving anybody of meat. I mean, I can afford to have meat, and that's what I'm used to. So by golly, I'm going to take what I want. I mean, if the little old lady down at the end of the table doesn't have enough meat, well, she probably probably doesn't need all that meat anyway. I mean, you know how older people are. They don't get around a lot, and they don't need the meat. And next to her is sitting. I mean, if you feel like a real assertive person, and maybe you have a little bit of power, you could go to the cook and you could say, "Well, listen, cook, how come you didn't cook a little bit of more meat? I mean, there's four or 500 people here. You should have cooked more meat." Well, maybe the cook would say, "Well, Werner Jensen, he's the purchasing man, and I suppose he's the one who decides how much we buy around. He said this was all the meat there was." Well, then you could go to Werner and you could kind of complain to him or say, "Look, really ought to provide a little bit more meat around this place." And his response might be, "Well, there wasn't any more available. I mean, that's all the meat I could get, or that's all of whatever I could get from the warehouse." So you could protest. Try to change things that way. The third thing is that you, knowing what the situation is, you could make a conscious and what I consider a faithful decision to take my fair share. Not pull rank, not demand an excess, but take my fair share so that there's enough for everybody else at the table too. And I think that's what we're called to do given the world situation. And ultimately, that's the only thing I can control is how much I eat or how much I consume. I've been operating under some false illusions that I can even control what my children's response will be in the matter of simplicity. But I can't do that. All I can do is control my own response, and maybe they'll catch on by example. Maybe they won't. Okay, I just want to, I guess, sum up what I have to say. I may have some more things to say, but maybe you all want to respond, is that the good news is that living a more conscious and single-minded, purposeful life is not a law. It's not a new law. It's not a striving to be simpler than your neighbor. It's a joyful and it's a freeing sort of lifestyle. The only way you can find that out is to try it. You can read about it and you can look at other people's lifestyles, but the only way you're going to find out that it really is freeing to simplify your life, to become more purposeful, is to take a small step. Don't try to take a big step, because if you take a big step, you'll probably get very discouraged and feel deprived, give up, whatever. Make some small changes in your life and find out, how does it feel? And then if it feels good to you, you can make more changes. Anybody want to react?
I think you left out one option on that. Another option was that you didn't have to take any meat.
Didn't what?
You didn't have to take any meat. You could have just had regular.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you don't have to take any. That response, and the reason I left that out, is that if that's a freely chosen response, that's fine. That comes real close to sounding like deprivation to some people. That I'm depriving myself. Okay? And I think that's a danger in talking about simplicity. People say, "Oh my God, I gotta give up everything I enjoy." And I don't think that's what we're being called to do. If you no longer enjoy meat, or if you feel that that's not being depriving yourself, then you give it up freely. But if you think, oh, I'm going to be sacrificial and I'm going to give up my portion of meat, you can get real grim about it. And
but that's the difference between law and gospel.
Right, right. Yeah.
And toss a couple more thoughts out myself here on the New Testament thing. In the passage on in the sixth chapter of Matthew, I just looked at my Bible to see it. It's a Jerusalem Bible. It says, if your eye is sound, your whole body will be filled with light. But I think if you have a different translation, you might find that it says, if your eye be single. And they maybe changed it to sound because the idea of having a single eye didn't look too good. But the point is, the single eye is the eye fixed upon a single thing. That's the point. And what's the single thing? It is the kingdom of God. We are to seek first the kingdom of God. Now, anything that's said about simplicity, I don't care who says it to you, whether it's somebody whose interest is just kind of ecological or whether it's some kind of religious thing, and does not say the simplicity of the spirit must be there first, you're in for trouble. You really ain't going to make it. The other way around, as we seek the kingdom of God first, we can let go of anxiety and fear and worry and hoarding and all those other kinds of things. That's really what it's all about. It's awfully hard to put that across. I think Nancy said, you know, we have to try it. But it begins to become a very joyful thing when you can start letting go. Like, for example, I'll give one example of out of our life. And there was a person that I talked to today about he's trying to save money to get his kids through college. Now, being simple doesn't mean that you don't have to plan ahead. The thing is, you don't have to worry about it. The kingdom of God is in college education isn't the kingdom of God either. And Nancy and I, for a while, I'd say 10, 12, 14 years ago, we began to try to save money to put our kids through college. And for one thing, we just weren't making enough money to make much of a dent in a college education. And finally, it came to the point where we just let go of worrying about it. And we took this pittance that we had accumulated and used it to help us when we moved into our new ministry in Kalamazoo, and we didn't get any pay at all from anybody. And our first son now is 2 years of college, and I don't know, it's just happening.
Do I get the feeling that you seem to think that if you're comfortable with the decision you make, whether it's about the need or whatever it is, this is more simplistic what you would like?
I would say that's a partially true. I wouldn't make it quite so casual as to say, well, I'm comfortable with what I'm doing. And I think, first of all, it's seeking the kingdom of God. Okay.
That goes back to what she said at the beginning, that a lot of people aren't even aware that we're in critical times. And if somebody's just comfortable with living whatever life they think is normal, we as Christians, working for voluntary enlistment, I said, but wait a minute, are you aware that what you're comfortable with really is ecologically unsound?
Yeah, I think that's...
To be an awareness of searching about reality somehow before you can then relax into it.
Yeah, I consciously chose not to give a bunch of statistics, you know, I mean, I think that almost everyone's heard it by now. Maybe we need to keep hearing it, that there are 10 people at the table and 2 of them are taking all the food, or those kinds of images that, like Rudy was saying yesterday, hey folks, used to be 12 inches of topsoil, now there's only 6. You know, we're going to run out. There is a limit. I guess I should have said at the beginning of the presentation, there's a lot of ways to get at simplicity and a lot of things you can say, and there's a lot of things we're not saying because they've been said before, or they've been approached in a different way. But yeah, you do have to perceive that there are limits if you're talking about in the area of consumption. I think there are other things to talk about in simplicity besides consumption. I think that's one aspect of it. It's the one that gets the most press.
Who would you assess talk about this paradox? Simplicity could be seen as giving up something or a negative in the sense of what I try to trim or what I try to discipline, what I try to materially, I try to cut down, I try to cut down. I can see it in that perspective, or the opposite, that if it's simplicity of the kingdom of God, I tend to focus and positively add that kind of a sense of deepening enjoyment, that the natural result of that is a falling away of other things that no longer hold their importance.
Yeah, that's that first definition I read at Greg, you know, consciously limiting something so that you can have more someplace else. And that's not in just in consumption, but if you give up being on three committees, you'll have more time to read or meditate.
Or do one committee well.
Yeah. You can see it as a giving up, or you can see it as a gaining, depending upon what your focus is.
Yeah.
But if you visualize, there's a limit to time. There's a limit to your energy. There's a limit to your health. Or what's healthy, then if you perceive that there's limits on everything, then you consciously choose what you want, what's important.
It's hard to put into words what seeking the kingdom of God is first. And I guess simplicity as a spiritual discipline needs to be in the harness with all the rest of the spiritual disciplines of meditation, prayer, silence, and so forth. And perhaps silence would be one way to begin to get at the discipline of simplicity also. Søren Kierkegaard said, I think he said, used the word purity of heart, but it's the same sense of simplicity I'm talking about, is to will one thing. And what is the one thing that you want to will? Well, for the Christian, it's to will what God wills. And until we bring our lives completely into alignment with God's will, we're going to be unhappy. It doesn't matter how much material things that we have. There's going to be something very unfulfilled about how we feel about things. And sometimes maybe just sitting in silence and do it for an hour a day if you have to. And start letting the depth of that sink in. You know, what is really important in life?
You think you're always going to know God's will?
No, I don't think that I'm ever going to know God's will completely, but I think it would be wrong to deny that I know a lot about it. I know quite a bit. I know almost more than I can handle right now. And if I start getting on with what I know, even, that's gonna be lots of fun.
I find the key is not really concentrating God's will. It's just knowing God's spirit. That's how I think of seeking the kingdom of God. It isn't like you give up saving for college education because you know God's going to come up with a miracle later on so you get to go to school. You just somehow know that when you're in that spirit of not worrying, that you're bowing more so that maybe you're not in God's way.
Maybe that's it. Get out of his way.
Talk about it in symbols. You know, when I read that passage from Deuteronomy that talks about the tithing and the super huge party, okay, and that's a vision of of the family or this clan getting together and sharing in the abundance, okay. Now in the New Testament, in a sense, that was limited, okay. That was limited to a particular family or grouping. In the New Testament, that is just broken wide open to include everybody and is best symbolized by the Eucharist, where everybody gets an equal portion of the whole shot, and that ought to just spill on over into what we're doing outside the table. We just take it right straight from that table and right out there and live that way, and the promises that you are going to be happy That's the really an accurate translation of the Beatitudes, not more than blessed, but happy.
What you were saying about poetry, and not, but I mean, the important part is that you still give the first part to the Lord, say the praise that comes in, and now they also see our church members. So you definitely set aside that you know that this is going to be what you are giving to the church. That set aside isn't at the end of the week or the end of come Sunday morning, and what I get fit, you know, I can get out of the door.
Mm-hmm.
Then, in other words, we know what we definitely are going to give to the church plus, if there's, that's possible. But then there is also one given amount that you give to missionaries. We have had brothers in that field, and like in the French tradition and all. When you stop to think of what they have given up as themselves, their beautiful home, or being out to keep the Lord, I'm not capable of doing it, but I certainly can help them on the field. Now that is not what I say part of my time. That's the extra. If you help them, what they ask for is prayer partners, and ordinarily it is, can we get them, say, $5 a month for something like that, then you can figure on that in a way. Girls in the community that they consider a prayer partner. So that doesn't mean a requirement, but prayer is the most important thing today. But the money helps keep them on the field. And what you're saying about people, yes, I think you can kind of count the nominees at the table if you are away from home. Talk to the head of the table. 8 people up here. All right, then you definitely know that the owner, the 8th of that servant and the dish, the owner that is more than his share. You can freely take less, but you're exceeding if you take more. The first time ever. My belief is you're trying to fit stick in the of trying to get the sort of a feasible thing. So they weigh the feasible plot. Believe it or not, came out of eat. Because the father got to learn the food because he had worked for it. My boys are considered in similar requirements. They were close to age. And so I got the father so that they could have kids and people. And I did that on the small piece. And when our daughter joined us, so I gave her a special small piece. But when they went out and worked on the farm, they did likewise. I mean, they the first time around, they quit. And I remember one of the town boys came out and they worked with another home. And then they went out and left out and I followed the church. And he was shocked because my father took the normal church. And where he had been before, he said, if I didn't, they might not now. How could you think of the word of the poor? He wouldn't have gotten very much good. And he was had to work the day that the moment it happened. So, now, first, I agree with you, definitely. We ought to seek the blessing of God that we've had in our life.
I don't think that you know, I don't think that the New Testament model of people holding all things in common is necessarily a model that should be a law placed on us either. It was their way of trying to experiment with a life that was joyful. I mean, it's almost like people who can, when the paycheck comes, you just about kind of start jumping up and down and say, now how can I use this for the benefit and the good, the greatest good, and bring about the most harmony? It's that kind of joyfulness with that paycheck. Now, in our community, we talk a lot about tithing, and you know that you're into a law discussion when someone says, well, is that a tithe of my pay before taxes or after taxes? You know, and that was a question came up, see? Well, all the joy is gone when you start doing that.
I think there's some other areas. We talk often about consumption and money, but there's some other areas to be considered when you're talking about simplicity. One is the area of work. What kind of work do you do? Is it work that is dehumanizing? Is it building up things or tearing down things? And I don't mean literally, but does it make a genuine contribution to you and to the rest of the human family? Do you have some sense of say in your work, of decisions that, do you have some participation in decisions about your work? What kind of a size of the workplace do you work? So these are all things that are I would say, liberating things that can help in your lifestyle, that can help you live a lifestyle of simplicity.
There's been several books written, particularly in relationship to public administration, those who work with the federal state, kind of talking about that type of system of equal human decision-making process in our democracy, which basic premise...
Speak up a little louder.
The basic premise of that is that the system controls the individual, not that the individual can control the system. That's the basis of democracy. The decision-making process is not for the problem solver or for the individual, but the system maintains the system.
Mm-hmm.
So, having come out of that governmental line myself for 8.5 years, and this line of simplicity of what you're talking about, since you brought that up, I would see that would be somewhat difficult within that type of system. Even though I know that you could have input in the very moment of decisions, still most decisions, large decisions that are ramifying over broad base, are not a problem-solving decision. It's compromise. The compromise is not problem-solving. So you never really truly solve a problem. Everybody gets a little bit, and it's a compromise. And my immediate question back on that was going to be, how about in that governmental type work? And so many people are employed now. It's a big part of our workforce. Do you think that they need to get into this type of simplicity?
Something to think about. Yeah, you really can. Yeah. Just one other area, and then I think we close it. I just want to mention that simplicity in communication. Now, I think this is a place of lots and lots and lots of words. Tried to keep at least some key ideas down here. But even in interpersonal communications, think about your speech. Is it simple, direct, honest? Do you look people in the eye? And how do you feel when you're communicating with somebody who uses a lot of words to say something very simple? Are you free to use other forms of communication? Are you free to give somebody a hug if you want to without thinking, oh my goodness, what will they think? Especially if it's somebody of the opposite sex. Can we communicate in a direct, honest way with each other? Give somebody a hug if you feel like doing that. Or giving, touching somebody without being so inhibited about that. That's simplicity in interpersonal communications. There's a lot of other areas that we can talk about, but Wanted to mention these books, if you're interested in talking about it more.
You mentioned that, not mentioned it.
Voluntary Simplicity is one. Another one that I don't have, I ran over to the library to get because I didn't bring my personal copy and I couldn't find it. Excellent little book called Enough is Enough by Taylor. If you haven't read that one, that's a good one to start. John and Mary Schramm's Things That Make for Peace. If you haven't read that one, that's a good one. These two. Some real practical, a couple real practical books. More with Less Cookbook. If you haven't read that, that's an excellent book. It's put out by the Mennonites, and it's a nice cookbook, and it gives you a lot of information besides recipes. And the other one is Living More with Less, that by the same woman who wrote More with Less. So those are some helps. Jerry's got a couple.
Yeah, these, I really would like to lift these up as something to take a peek at and to have. Richard Foster wrote both of them. Celebration of Discipline is just a superb book on spiritual growth, the path to spiritual growth, and it has spiritual disciplines that all of us try to practice probably at some time or another in one way or another. I've never seen anyone put it more succinctly and to cast discipline in the light of grace, not a law. My goodness, I've got to do this, I've got to do that. He has a way of saying, oh, this is what the discipline is. This is what it is not. And he puts it always in the side of kind of a joyfulness about it. And then one of the disciplines in this book, Celebration of Discipline, is simplicity. And so he lifts that out and does a whole book on the freedom of simplicity. And this is one of the best books, I think, that try to discuss this. It's an issue that in our lives it can cause a lot of anxiety. It can easily slide into guilt trips. Getting down to nitpicking, like, should I have a dishwasher or shouldn't I, and all that kind of stuff. And he gets us sort of on a plane of the grace of God, and then how that can begin to work itself out. And I would highly recommend both of Foster's books. He really does a nice job.
Besides that, they're in the bookstore.
And they're in the bookstore. Shanti, shanti, shanti. Do you know the song Simple Gifts, the Quaker song? Let's use it to close with. How many of you know it? Not many. Well, we'll sing it. We'll sing the first verse through twice, and then you'll learn.
Tis a gift to be simple. Tis a gift to be free. Tis a gift to come down where we ought to be. And when we find ourselves in the place just right, 'twill be in the valley.